Blog Talk Radio.
Freedom. I am Leslie Gist. Tonight we have a very special guest. His name is Mr. Paul Stewart. Paul, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line, and my wife Mary Liz is here too.
Great. How are you, Mary Liz? Can
very
you hear
good.
Us?
Very good, Leslie. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Wonderful. We had a great conversation. I'm on the phone earlier, and I just hope that it is the same on the show. Could you introduce yourself, starting with Paul?
Well, in terms of introductions, I mean, the two of us have been, we're co-founders of this Underground Railroad History Project, and I actually work for a not-for-profit organization called the Community Loan Fund of the Capital Region of Upstate New York, and you know, my spare time, I do work around this issue of the Underground Railroad, researching the story, rediscovering the story, and telling the story. Mary?
I'm an educator. I teach 5th and 6th grade social studies right now for a school district in Southwest Albany County in New York State. And, oh, was it about 25 miles southwest of the city of Albany, and I've been there for 16 years, and for me, my involvement with this Underground Railroad history started to take root, about 12 years ago, in my fifth grade classroom, and the interest was something that went well beyond classroom time, and so I teamed up with Paul, and we put our energies to use together researching local Albany history, focusing on Underground Railroad history and the involvement of local residents in that history. And we're very, very much excited about some of the history we were uncovering in newspapers and period documents.
Yeah.
And so that started the ball rolling.
Yeah. I've always been, I think I've always been interested in history. It seems to me I have. And some years ago, I started doing some writing for community newspapers, and I did some work for really a variety. I started with doing some articles for the Chicago, the Chicago, at any rate, it was the South Side newspaper in Chicago when we lived there, and then here in Albany, wrote for the Scene newspaper, the South End Scene initially, but then it changed its name to the Scene, which was a black inner-city newspaper, just focused on urban news and things that were happening. And I wrote a little history articles for the paper on stuff that I would research, you know, in my lunch hour, basically, or because I worked not too far from the New York State Museum, which is a world-class research library. So I would go up there in my lunchtime and rummage around in the stacks and see what I could find. And I always try to tie it into local history. So I did do a couple of articles on some Underground Railroad related topics, but subsequent to our joint project, our study, you know, I had never gotten into it as deeply as we did after we got going. So,
okay, I'm curious, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You teach fifth grade, right?
Yeah, fifth and sixth grade. Yeah.
Okay, what story was the story that prompted you to get involved with this research? Do you remember the lesson that you were teaching?
Well, I do, actually. What I was doing was reading with some students in my fifth grade classroom a children's version or a student's version of Harriet Tubman's biography. And as fifth graders generally tend to be, they're still very concrete thinkers. And so they were really having a hard time getting their head around or understanding this concept of Underground Railroad as a period in American history. They were very much stuck with images of subways and above-ground mechanical trains. And so in order to help them to take the steps I was hoping they would take to come to understand this period in history, I invited those who were interested to join me in researching history in the community where the school is based to see if we could uncover some information, some documented information about Underground Railroad activities or activists who lived in the neighborhood, with the thought that if it's in their backyard, it's closer to home and easier for them to understand. Well, we did find a little bit of information, which was pretty exciting, but these students were all moved on, you know, to sixth grade, and at that point I was just a fifth grade teacher. So while they moved on, my own interest remained. And initially I was hoping to continue the research in the community where the school is based, but found because that school district is 25 miles from where we live in Albany, it was a little tough to keep it going. So hence I decided to refocus my energies to what is home base for us, which is the city of Albany.
Okay, and if you remember, what did the fifth graders uncover?
Oh, golly, we'd be trying to think now. It's been a while, so
okay.
Some of the details are fuzzy or lost, but what I do remember was uncovering certainly references to people in the community where the school is based who are identified as enslavers. And while we were not able to uncover names of individuals who were enslaved, nonetheless, there were a number of families in the school district community who were enslavers prior to 1827, when the institution of slavery was abolished in New York State. So that certainly was some, you know, quite some unsettling news for a lot of folks, because they had no sense, no concept that this was part of their community heritage. We did uncover some references to a couple of people who we suspected were abolitionists, but the documented information wasn't solid enough for us to come forward and say, yes, definitely these people were. But as I say, you know, there were suggestions that there were some abolition activists in the community who were more engaged.
Now, you said you moved your project to your home because of logistic reasons,
yeah.
Closer to your home.
Yeah,
tell me, the first project that you worked on mutually, tell me more about that.
Well, we started, we kind of had a series of things that wanted to explore. We thought what we'd do is go around and talk to some experts who could tell us a little bit about the Underground Railroad and things that happened in the area and things like that. And the experts told us things that we had kind of heard echoed in a lot of other places, things like, you're never going to find too much, there's not too much documentation, it's all secret, you're not going to find anything, you know, because of that. Things happen in the area, but a little bit away, 15 miles away in another community up the river, things like that, or even everything you know, related to the river, the Hudson River, which is a main thoroughfare for trade in the region. But and then we said, well, jeepers, you know, one of the things that always sort of tickled us is people would say, well, there's not much we can tell you about the story in this area. And we would say, okay, fine. Well, tell me about the not much part. You know, they really didn't have much to say for that either. So
we went
looking at we started to read generally.
If I could just interrupt for a second and say I remember having what I tend to laughingly call, you know, staff meetings at the kitchen table.
Right.
And Paul and I looked at each other, and I remember a little conversation about this not much reference, and then we decided, well, let's go see what that not much is. And
yeah.
that and so we started
That's a great
and
book
we started
title.
Reading. And what we did was we went back to, you know, what might be considered primary sources or critical sources on the story of the Underground Railroad generally. And what we found when we were reading those things is every time we came across a story that related to our region or our community, we would sort of like a little check mark would go off in our head, you know. And then after a while, we had seen about 10 of those, and we said, you know, I don't know about, you know, why nobody told us these stories. So we started accumulating those stories, and
give me one of the stories, one of the most profound stories under the not much category.
Well, the most profound story, I think, is the story of Stephen and Harriet Myers, and they were two African Americans who were born in this area. Stephen was born in Rensselaer County, which is across the river from Albany County, and he was born in 1800, and in 1800, New York was a slave state. And so he was born into slavery, and at the age of 18, he was set free. 1827 is when slavery was abolished in New York State. And so, as you come along with his history, you begin to see in the early 1830s, he is beginning to do things that are showing up on record as an anti-slavery activist. And two of the records in particular that I'm referring to, one is a newspaper account where he talks about as early as 1831, helping others who had been enslaved to make their way to freedom. And then also in what we call our city directories, which is a listing. You know, if you go into a city, you can go to a phone book in general, but oftentimes cities will also have a city guide or a city directory where either all the people in the community are listed, or at least all the important businesses and churches and other institutions in the community are listed, and who the people are that are connected with those institutions. So in Albany, we had this thing called a city directory, and in 1831 city directory, Stephen Myers is listed along with a number of other people as forming a Clarkson anti-slavery group. It's called named after this guy Clarkson, who was a famous abolitionist. And so they met in one of the community centers, churches, whatever, in this area. And then as you go forward with this story of Stephen, you know, we found that Stephen, married this woman, Harriet, Johnson, who then became Harriet Myers. And they had four children. And all the while they had four children and were working on life as it would be, trying to make a living, et cetera. They were also working as agents on the Underground Railroad, and they were assisting freedom seekers that were coming through the community. And so everywhere they lived, by the time you get into the 1840s, every place where they lived was a place where Underground Railroad activity was taking place. And so we were able to find one of the buildings that was still standing. You know, there was the wrecking ball and urban renewal and fires and other kinds of catastrophes that got to many of the other sites. But we did find one building that was still standing that was where they had lived in the mid-1850s. And when we found that building, we went to the owner and said, hey, listen, you got a gem here. This is fantastic. This is part of African-American history. This is something that should be preserved. He said, great. I'd love to give you the building, but it's got a lot of liens against it. So there was a complicated process we had to go through with him and an attorney, and then ultimately the county. And finally then we were, as we organized the not-for-profit organization called the Underground Railroad History Project, we were able to purchase that from the county, purchase the building.
And what year was this?
This was in 2004. And
okay.
We've been working on restoring the building to what it looked like. So the Stephen Myers and Harriet Myers, their story, I think, was fantastic story, a witness to what people can do and to what people in our community. community have done. And there are many other people that worked with them. So their story is not a story alone, but a story that's part of a broader community of forms.
Now, could you give us a bird's eye view or, a fly on the wall's view of what's inside the building?
Well, there's what's inside the building now, and then there's what's inside the building when it gets done.
And, okay, great.
What's inside the building now is the building is a construction site. We're working on restoration, and part of what that means is that we've got the building cleaned out and ready for work to be done, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's, the balustrades and the banisters are not there for every floor. The plaster maybe is
mm-hmm.
cracking, et cetera. But all this is in process, and we're going to be doing work on it. And so we do invite people to come in and look at the place and to be in the space where this history happened, which I think is really, really important.
Maybe I could also say, too, the process of restoration is a very challenging and slow-moving process because the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence is on the National Historic Register, National Register of Historic Places is the proper title, and it's also part of the National Park Service Network to Freedom. And so with those designations, we are obligated, which is fine by us, but it does obligate us as an organization to restore the building to the federal guidelines that are put out by the Department of Interior. So there are a number of preparatory steps that we've had to go through with assessments and reports from professionals to determine what the current conditions are of the building, what would be required to restore the building. And it's a very labor-intensive and very lengthy process. And the other thing that makes the process take long is that the restoration actually involves replacing 1847 when the building was built, replacing that deteriorated 1847 brick with brick of like kind. So we have to, be sure that any glass panes we put in, any wood that we put in, any bricks and mortar that go in are things that are of the same materials and character as what was originally used. So it's an exciting process because it means that the building will truly be will have the character of the building from when Stephen and Harriet Myers lived there, which is the most historic period for this building. But it also does mean that we have to be very painstaking about all the work that gets planned out and carried out. So, but it's also been an exciting step for the community, the immediate community in which the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence is based. And it's also an exciting component of development within the city of Albany as well, that we have such a rich historic treasure in our midst.
Right. Now, what in the house, is there any evidence that this was an Underground Railroad stop? You read about some homes, they have secret hiding spots.
Well, that's an interesting question because I think this is a place where the realities of history kind of buck up against the notions of history that we have based on notable stories that have caught our imagination. And so many of the stories that really capture people's imagination are stories that have, secret hiding places and that sort of thing. But if you go back and you really read a lot of these accounts, somebody who was making their way to freedom and maybe traveling along a road, they heard, horses coming, so they got off the road, and then when they were able to get back on the road, they traveled so far and they found somebody's home, and that person put them up for the night. Now, there's no discussion in that account of them being hidden in a secret place. They were just put up for the night. And so when we really start to think about the story of the Underground Railroad and the stories that we've learned that have been passed on to us, that in many cases there were not secret compartments sort of thing, but places set aside for company. There's a fascinating story I remember reading about a guy by the name of Reverend Pennington, who was a noteworthy fellow among Underground Railroad activists. He was an African-American minister in Connecticut, and when a person approached him on the street and said, you know, do you know of a place to stay? He said, no, we have no place to stay. There's no place available for you. But then they carried on a conversation, and he determined that this person was, in fact, a fugitive from slavery. He said, yes, we have a place for you. You know, we have a room set aside. You know, so
right.
It wasn't, I think in every case it was not the kind of thing that we imagined with secret compartments and rooms.
You mentioned that slavery was abolished in what year?
1827.
So it wouldn't be necessary to have a secret hiding place in Albany. But in the South, Underground Railroad safe haven would have to have one. Could you elaborate?
Well, there was, even though New York State abolished the institution of slavery in 1827, all that really meant was that people who claimed New York State as their place of residence could no longer legally own another human being. Laws in New York State were written such that there were laws that protected the enslaver-enslaved relationship for people who would come into New York State from slaveholding states and bring with them people who were enslaved to them. We have found that some of the reasons that people from slaveholding states would come into New York State were for business dealings, economic interests. We have vacation spots in New York State that were very attractive to people who lived outside the state, and educational institutions, even in the 1800s, were considered of such high quality that oftentimes sons from slaveholding families would be sent to academic institutions in New York State. So there's all these relationships that New York State legislators were very concerned about and wanted to maintain. So there were laws on the books that protected the enslaver-enslaved relationship and created an environment that allowed for slave catchers, as we routinely call them, to pursue individuals who had escaped enslavement, for instance, into New York State. And there are times when those pursuits sort of boiled over into kidnapping of free African Americans who were then sold into slavery. It was still, even though 1827 is a year where the institution was abolished, there still was a tremendous amount of involvement on the part of New Yorkers in supporting this institution, and the result was that this really became still a very unsafe place.
Right. And you kind of lay on top of that the federal fugitive slave laws, which particularly with the 1850, the federal fugitive slave law, which created these local commissioners that were supposed to enforce the fugitive slave laws. And so that added an additional complication. And so even though it was a free state, you know, that freedom didn't necessarily mean that everybody was, you know, free and not pursued or not under threat.
Mm-hmm.
So it was still a tricky place to live.
And there are accounts that we have uncovered of slave catchers making their way into the city of Albany, the city of Troy, which is east across the Hudson River from Albany. And with the accounts we've uncovered of freedom seekers, it seems to tell us very clearly that some individuals felt safe to remain in the city of Albany, for instance, or in the capital region and set up a life for themselves, but many others felt very afraid to stay here because of the pursuit that they feared. And so that, you know, those freedom seeker accounts, as well as the existence of vigilance committees in cities in the capital region, which, of course, were comprised of people, of abolitionists who had many purposes, but one of them was to be on the lookout, to be vigilant for slave catchers coming into the cities and towns. And those things also tell us that that there was a great deal of risk present here.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any accounts of a physical altercation with the abolitionists and the enslavers?
Actually, there are a bunch, but one of the most well-known, of course, is the story of Charles Now, who came up into the Tri-Cities area here, Albany, Schenectady, Troy. He settled in Troy, or near Troy, and while he was there making a living for himself, some people that he had had contact with in connection with a school where he was trying to learn to read actually wrote the folks in Virginia who had been his enslavers and tried to make some money off the deal. And so the enslavers, the Hansboroughs, came up from Virginia looking for him and tried to capture him on the street. And a big fight broke out, which ultimately resulted in this the well-known rescue of Charles Now, where Harriet Tubman was involved. But there were lots of other stories as well about fights on the street between abolitionists and pro-slavery and anti-slavery people going on into the 1840s and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned on the telephone earlier that Mr. Myers
was
involved with a newspaper.
Right. Stephen Myers was involved with something called the Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate. And actually, Stephen Myers had been involved with publishing a number of different newspapers, anti-slavery and abolition and temperance newspapers over the years. But the one that lasted the longest was this one called the Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate. And I want to point out that people often confuse it with the North Star, which was published by Frederick Douglass out of Rochester and pretty widely known. But I think we're in the process of sorting this out, but I think that there were the Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate was fairly widely known as well, at least from what we can see in terms of who the people were who were distributing the newspaper. There were agents in Philadelphia, agents in Buffalo, agents in Maine and in Boston. I think that in terms of how people remember history, sometimes they remember things for different reasons. And Stephen Myers didn't live too much past the Civil War. And Frederick Douglass lived almost to the beginning of the 20th century. And so because he lived longer and had a life on the scene after the Civil War, I think he's more remembered than... And the same I would say with Harriet Tubman. They're more remembered than people whose lives either ended before the Civil War or right around the time of the Civil War who were involved in this history.
Well, it seems like New York, you named a few cities and towns in New York where you guys are from, near Albany.
Right.
Seems like that was a hotbed of abolitionist activity.
Well,
similar to Ohio. Could you give us a flavor of what was going on and what made New York, that area, so attractive to abolitionists?
Well, I'm not sure what made it, in one sense, I'm not quite so sure what made it attractive in one sense. In another sense, I mean, it was a huge area. You know, I think that when you look at the map and you see that, say, New York City is at the tip end of the Hudson River, and you see all this other geography up there that goes all the way up to Plattsburgh and all the way west out to Buffalo. There's cities and towns all over that, all over the earth. And particularly with the opening of the Erie Canal in the mid-1820s and the Champlain Canal in the mid-1830s, all of that area was able to be connected in a way that people would never have imagined prior to that was possible. And transportation was revolutionized. People were able to travel much more quickly along these river routes, canal routes. So within that setting, there were many, many people that were focused in on this issue. Mary, did you have?
Well, I was just going to say too, Albany really is at the geographic crossroads, if you will, of As Paul mentioned, the Champlain and the Erie Canal, the Hudson River, so that the geographic location made Albany a city that grew, actually doubled in size across the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And just as neighboring cities in the capital region were growing, Albany still remained the largest of those capital region cities. And of course, it's the seat of government, state government for New York State. So there was certainly a lot of interest in lobbying for human rights issues that would draw people here from both sides of the aisle. And so Albany, as I mentioned, as I said, was something of a hub of activity during this time period. As well, I think it's good to remember too that in 1844, I think it was, Paul, David Ruggles, who was a very strong abolition activist in New York City, commented that Stephen Meyer's station on the Underground Railroad was the best-run station in all of New York State. So Stephen Meyer's had developed a reputation of work, the quality of work that also, I think, drew people here to work on the Underground Railroad. In fact, well, William Henry Johnson came here to work with Stephen Meyer's, so as one example.
Could you just identify and give us a snippet of a background about those two gentlemen you mentioned?
Let's see, just now?
Yeah.
We had Ruggles and...
David Ruggles,
right.
and
William Henry Johnson.
Right. Well, David Ruggles was probably best known for his role in the Vigilance Committee for the Underground Railroad in New York City in the 1830s. A bold... person in terms of advocacy and whatnot, you know, one of his most famous bold actions was to go right into a slave owner's home in New York City, person that had somebody that they had enslaved, to walk right into that slave owner's home and inform the slave owner and the person enslaved that they could not that he could not have this person in slavery because it was. Person was technically free because this was a state, you know, where it was abolished, and then offering to escort that person out of the house, you know, much to the chagrin, shock, and surprise of the slaver. and he had lots of other stories, and he got into a lot of confrontational situations. You know, people tried to burn his bookstore down. He was the first African American to operate a bookstore that's on, as far as record is concerned, And he had lots of run-ins with pro-slavery people, you know, in New York City, to try to, you know, keep him from, you know, they would make accusations against him and whatnot, and he just really was, you know, did a lot of fighting in that regard to.
Now we spoke about this earlier on the phone, and I would like for Mary, right, your wife,
mm-hmm.
to address
yes.
this question. As a school teacher,
uh-huh.
the story that you guys are telling me over the phone,
mm-hmm.
did you find anything in your textbooks about this type of, about the Vigilance Committee, period, and this type of confrontation where you had individuals confronting
mm-hmm.
These slavers and enslaved people and telling them, you know, that you are in a free state and, you know, you need to be free? Did you find any of these types of stories anywhere
no.
as a teacher?
No. Not, I would say, the short answer is no, but I should be qualified. This kind of information does not show up in the standard canon or the standard retelling that usually gets carried forward to students in classrooms in New York State. I think it was New York State Education Department, I think by now it was 3 years ago, had organized what was called an Amistad Commission, which was supposed to remedy this lack of information and accurate retelling. I have not been aware, though, that commission has been able to achieve its goal of providing curricular in materials to enhance the story that is routinely told. So what happens is, you know, is frequently unless there is some particular focus or work done by the individual classroom teacher. The standard retelling remains the story of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. Sometimes Sojourner Truth is brought in at middle school level, because here in New York State we have New York State and United States history at 4th and 5th grade, and then we return to United States history in 7th grade. And so the... I would have to say there really has not been much change in the telling of the story of the Underground Railroad.
And how common is this vigilance committee and their activity? Because, you know, I've researched in Philadelphia with William Steele,
mm-hmm.
and that was very common. You know, there's stories of Jane Johnson being approached at the ferry and, you know, being told by the vigilance committee members that she was free because she was in Philadelphia. You know,
well, I think it was in many of the large cities across the country in the north, there were vigilance committees. So there was one in Philadelphia, New York, Boston,
mm-hmm.
Albany, Troy,
mm-hmm.
Syracuse. I believe there was one in Buffalo as well. Rochester.
Do you think they were very effective?
Well, ultimately, I guess I'd have to say yes. You know, I mean, you wanted, on the one hand, you know, you had many, many people coming through who were making their way to freedom, either in the north to settle or go on to Canada. And the committees themselves were very active in terms of trying to keep slave catchers from being able to kidnap people. But and then ultimately the work that they did was part of what the Southern pro-slavery people were reacting to when
right.
they seceded from the Union and created the Civil War.
Two questions. And how far are you away from Canada?
What, about 250 miles?
Yeah.
So something 250, 300, yeah, from where we are in Albany.
Mm-hmm. And that would probably make your area very popular, a popular route.
Sure.
Right.
I want to mention that we've in order to tell this story, we put together a not-for-profit organization called the Underground Railroad History Project, and we have a website, www.ugrworkshop.com, and also we have a Facebook page, which is
mm-hmm.
Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region. So people are on Facebook, they can see that. And we report in those places about the activities, and one of the things that we have done as an organization is we've been having an annual conference, and we've been having that conference every year since 2001 or 2002. And the conference has been an excellent place where people can come and learn details about the history, hear some major speakers, hear some music, see some artists. You know, there are programs that are focused toward young people and kids and families, and there are workshops that are more academically oriented. So,
and you said this takes place at a college, right?
Yeah, we're doing it right now at Russell Sage College in Troy, New York. And, you know, we've had a wonderful time, I'd say 350 to 400 people commonly in recent conferences to participate and hear things. And we put out a call for proposals, and people can submit you know, a description of what they'd like to present in our committee.
And when is the next date?
It's April 13, 14, and 15. So it's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in 2012.
Okay.
We've
and
always...
Your web, and your contact information? Again, your email or phone number?
Mm-hmm.
Someone should call if they want to submit
a
proposal.
www.ugrworkshop.com.
Okay, now, I know you mentioned you're part of the New York State Underground Railroad Network.
The Underground Railroad Heritage Trail,
yeah.
Say it again.
The Underground Railroad Heritage Trail.
Okay.
The Stephen and Myers Stephen and Harriet Myers residences as part of that trail, and then we do.
And how is New York State Tourism Department getting involved with the Underground Railroad? Is there something exciting going on right now?
I'd say yes.
Right.
We had recently efforts were put forward to organize a FAM tour, familiarization tour, through I Love New York and connect with some British tour agents and journalists and invite them to go on a New York statewide tour of Underground Railroad historic sites. And that actually did take place, and now things are afoot for next summer to bring some British tourists to New York State to have a tour focused on Underground Railroad history. So we're really excited about that. And then there is certainly an ongoing effort around the state to continue to invite and excite New York State residents and neighboring state residents to visit Underground Railroad sites within New York State.
Now, throughout your research, did you find any British or UK connection with Myers or anyone in Albany?
Not specifically. There were individuals from. Well, let me back up. There were individuals from the United Kingdom or from Britain who came over here and spoke different places, but.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Highland Garnett, who was a minister in Troy, which is the city not far from here, he, along with others, did go over in the 1850s, in late 1840s and 1850s, to speak for what they called the free produce movement over in England and in France and in Germany and Ireland. And so Henry Highland Garnett, Frederick Douglass, and I want to say William Wells Brown, I think
mm-hmm.
it was, they went over and they spoke to large crowds in England and in Ireland and France and Germany to urge them not to buy produce or products that were made with slave labor. So that was a connection there, which I think is... often overlooked in terms of the role that they played in terms of agitating over in Europe, which ultimately paid off when the Civil War came up, because there was a large anti-slavery constituency built up and activized in these areas. And when the Confederacy went there to try to persuade them to come into the war on their side, particularly trying to get Britain to come into the war because Britain was using a lot of cotton, they didn't do it. They didn't do it because there was a large anti-slavery constituency that was, against that there. So
there also
and
was,
that goes back. Go ahead.
I was just going to say there also was a connection between Reverend Nathaniel Paul, who was an African American minister and abolition activist in the city of Albany. Who had taken the cause, if you will, the fundraising cause, to Britain, and then also had some connection with George Thompson in Edinburgh, Scotland. George Thompson then did come to speak in the United States, not in the capital region, but I believe in Philadelphia and perhaps, not sure. I remember a Philadelphia reference, though, for George Thompson, and there was then an establishment of a Thompson. What was the name of it, Paul? Thompson in Albany. I'm drawing a blank here on the full name.
Well,
but there was,
that's okay. What the point that you're making, and I was trying to get at, and you did a great job of, is to show that we love Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
But this Underground Railroad movement was an international movement.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, even though they show pictures of her walking, treading through the woods with a lantern and everything,
mm-hmm.
It was much bigger than her walking through the woods with a gun and a lantern and a few people behind her.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was a support network from all walks of life and different races and ethnicities and you know, it's amazing. And I think we as educators, we don't touch on the Underground Railroad nearly as important in the work that they did,
mm-hmm.
and the enormity of it. And that goes back to 1850.
Yeah.
The Fugitive Slave Law, you mentioned earlier, was a reaction to all of the success and effectiveness of the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
You had slave, as you described, as a slave labor boycott, an international slave labor boycott. And this 1850 law, I want you guys to explain, what did it do? And now we know why they hadn't had it, but exactly how did it work in 1850? What was going on when this law was passed?
Well, 1850 federal fugitive slave law, fugitive slave law was the second federal law on the books to that effect. It was a stronger law than the 1793 federal fugitive slave law. The 1850 federal fugitive slave law put into place commissioners who were responsible to enforce this law, which allowed for the provided for the apprehension of people who were claimed to have escaped enslavement and, of course, arranged for their return to enslavement, as well people who were identified as supporters or providers of assistance to those who had escaped enslavement, I think it was a $1,000 fine and 6-month jail term to which they could be sentenced.
This was in the North where slavery was abolished.
Right, because this applied, there's a federal law that applied to every state in the nation. And it, in New York State, we know that it was, a very sad commentary on the state of affairs at the time, in that when someone was apprehended and brought before a U.S. commissioner, the individual brought before the commissioner in New York State had no right to speak for himself or herself. So any decision made by the U.S. commissioner on whether or not the apprehended individual really was had escaped enslavement was based upon any documentation and verbal accounts that were given by the pursuer.
Right.
He certainly had a vested interest in the outcome. The additional, what to me, again, is very sad commentary on the state of affairs at the time, is that the U.S. commissioner, if he decided, in fact, that the person brought before him was not an escaped individual, then, and the person was allowed to go free, the U.S. commissioner would be paid $5. If U.S. commissioner decided, in fact, the person brought before him was someone who had escaped enslavement and needed to be returned, the commissioner would be paid $10. So we have here a system of justice that's a little bit askew. You know, there was certainly the financial payment to the commissioner would certainly be something of consideration when making a decision as to whether or not someone needed to be returned to the place. And the whole, I have to admit, I so often when talking about the federal fugitive slave law, I think about Frederick Douglass's comment about people who escaped conditions of enslavement were stealing their own labor. And I just think, you know, what does that mean? What does that really say to us about one's labor? And,
right. And in 1793, the original fugitive slave law guaranteed a warrant and due process.
Mm-hmm.
And this law was take away those due processes.
Right.
And so it was a way of stripping the Constitution of one of the first laws that they put in place to start the gradual abolishment of slavery.
Yeah.
And this is always a debate. But I always wanted to talk about that because it just shows how effective that the slavers were willing to compromise. During the 1850 fugitive slave law, we had something taking place in California, the gold rush. Do you guys want to talk about the connection between the gold rush and the compromise which led to this fugitive slave law?
Well, the gold rush obviously was in full swing in the late 1840s, and there
1849,
were even
49, right?
People in California that were trying to use slave labor, and California
mm-hmm.
was in Congress. They were negotiating about how to bring California into the Union, and California was actually below. There was a certain parallel that they had previously agreed that they were not going to have any slave states, or excuse me, any free states below that particular line. California would have been one of the things to break that agreement that they had had. And so I'm not sure of all...
Henry Clay, I think it was Henry
yeah.
Clay, he was the one who compromised and said, we'll allow... We out of Kentucky, we will allow California to come in as a free state as long as you pass this law for the fugitive slave law, saying
yeah.
that we can go back into the North and stop this Underground Railroad movement. So I just thought that was a powerful testament
yeah.
of what was going on with the Underground Railroad and how successful, you know,
it
they
is,
were
it
that
is,
they were willing to give up the gold.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
You know. So I think we had a great talk. Before we hang up, though, let's talk about that inflatable house.
Yeah.
I just posted it all over Facebook. I have you guys on my Facebook page in the house. Talk about that house. I think that's amazing.
Well, the back in 2008, there were some students from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Dara Greenwald, Josh McPhee, and Olivia Robinson, and they were doing a course on inflatable art, and they put together this replica of the Liberty Street Church, which was the church that Henry Highland Garnett was the pastor of in the 1840s, and it was a major Underground Railroad center. In May of 2008, they set up this inflatable, and it was really, it's amazing. If anybody wants to take a look at what the work that they did, they should look up this on Google or some other search engine, Spectres of Liberty, S-P-E-C-T-R-E-S, Spectres of Liberty. And this idea, the idea they're having is the ghost of, that this image was the ghost of the Liberty Street Church. And, you know, it might be kind of hard to imagine this as the ghost of the church just to look at it. But when you see it on the video that that they took, and, of course, you know, we were able to be there at the time when this was done. You do get that sense of the ghostliness of the past and the church being resurrected or revived in the 21st century. So we talked with them. We were able to get the inflatable, and we are going to erect this inflatable on the campus of Russell Sage College when we have the conference there in April.
And if I can just add that while the idea of an inflatable piece of artwork that replicates the Liberty Street Church may sound rather odd or unusual, what it does for us is allows us to step into, and we can step inside this inflatable art piece, and it allows us to experience the power of place. And if I could go back to when we were talking about the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, that as well is for Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region, one of its major goals is to reclaim the not just the physical space, but the experience of that space, so that those of us today can reach back in time and connect with, and again, this is through the conference as well, you know, connect with the courage and the fortitude of the freedom seekers and the abolitionists, and by reaching back and touching them and hearing their voices, we can be inspired today to continue working to fight the injustices that continue to plague us, many of which have their roots back in this institution of slavery that was allowed to be practiced for so many years. So the Liberty Street Church is just a phenomenal experience that allows us, again, to connect, you know, in a very real, sensual way with history.
And this is like a movable or a mobile museum. This
Absolutely.
This is has anyone ever used this type of art in the Underground Railroad movement?
Other than the May 2008 program that was done, I've not heard of anything. So this is.
And how much money and time did it take to design it and to get this project off, the inflatable project?
Well, I think it had to be done within the course of a semester initially. In terms of how much money or investment there was, I'm really not sure. But in terms of what we're doing right now, we're doing several practices to practice runs to make sure that we understand how to do this and do it right. And, you know, we hope to have all that ready and be ready to present this in April at the annual conference.
Okay, so let's end with the information once again slowly about your conference and all your contact information.
Okay. Well,
the conference, the 11th Annual Underground Railroad History Conference, titled Turning the Underground Railroad on Its Head, Old Themes, New Directions, is scheduled for April 13, 14, and 15 of 2012, and it will be held at Russell Sage College in Troy, New York. Paul, do you want to do the other?
Yeah, people, if they want more information, they can go to www.ugrworkshop.com. They can also look us up on Facebook at Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region on Facebook.
And there is an email contact available on the website, so we can always be reached that way as well.
Send an email.
Well, I had a wonderful time talking to you. I learned a great deal about the Underground Railroad and everything that you're doing for the last 15 years. And I want to thank you, and I hope to meet you in person.
Thank you.
That would be wonderful.
Okay, and have a great night, and keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Bye. Nice to talk with you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.